Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. We are back with a new book. How are you doing, JP?
I am pretty good. Today has been a very entertaining day in the Twitter sphere, so there's a lot going on.
What's funny is this is publishing in give or take 3 weeks or a month or so, and so it'll be such a funny time capsule. And if you haven't, we'll make sure to link this in the notes if you haven't seen this and it's been a month, because it will still be endlessly entertaining. So give us a little recap of what's been going on the Twitterverse today, on the programmer drama.
Yeah, programmer drama. I wonder if it'll be deleted in a month, but we'll have to see. Basically, there was a job posting. I won't say any of the companies or any of the people, I guess, because that's kind of weird. But there was a job posting on GitHub that had basically asked for developers who are willing to work 60 hours a week or something like that. And we all know our Lord Savior, DHH. I'm just kidding. But DHH is, if you follow him on Twitter, you'll know that he's very strongly against working really late hours. And he really believes in the idea that you're able to get a good amount of work done and actually be truly productive in a 40-hour week. Which is cool. It's cool that he's a strong advocate for that, basically. But
especially with how much he gets done. I can't think of very many other people. I would actually put him in the same categories of a Steve Jobs or an Elon Musk as far as how much he's accomplished and continues to accomplish. He might not have that global impact, but the guy kicks ass. I mean, manages a framework and a very large company. But anyway, so yeah, he on Twitter today, DHH, here we go.
Yeah. I don't know if it was today that he called him. I think it was actually a couple days ago that he basically highlighted this job posting that was saying hey, this is not chill, basically. And GitHub, you shouldn't allow these types of things. And the guy who posted the job posting actually responded in a very entertaining manner, I guess. Oh, gosh, it's just so crazy. He basically had called DHH and was I'm being attacked by all of his fanboys. I mean, I guess we're two DHH fanboys ourselves, but it's neither here nor there. But basically, a bunch of people had come out to defend DHH on Twitter. It's this huge storm of some people like working that much and some people don't like working that much. You can't actually be productive if you work 60 hours a week and this and that. And I don't know. It's been all very entertaining, I must say.
Yeah. It's funny. So what he does this every once in a while. He will find a ridiculous job post that's we're looking for someone who knows how to hustle. We work 60-hour work weeks. And that's the kind of jobs. And he constantly tweets links to them. And he'll say things someone prioritizing killing yourself over building a quality product. And he kind of adds his two cents, because his whole shtick right now is this calm company shtick, which they always have been kind of the company of mindfulness and getting a lot done with less. I mean, that's what Rails kind of preaches, is to be a highly productive with less, kind of a minimalist approach to things. But what's fun about this one is the CEO who posted this job post is they're going back and forth, and it's very childish and it's very entertaining to watch. But I think it's a good conversation to have. What is the balance of hustle? Especially you, JP, I kind of want to ask you work full time. You're starting to do a little bit of side projects, and I don't know anyone who reads more books or who works on programming more than you. How do you find the balance of what that looks like in your life? And do you feel like you found a healthy balance now?
I don't know. I see both perspectives. I think an employer should only expect 40 hours of work out of their employee, and you could definitely get a lot done in 40 hours. And you should have a project manager or someone who's managing your time, basically. Because we work inside of sprints. And so ideally the sprint that you're in contains just the right amount of work. And even if it doesn't, you should be able to communicate and say hey, this is actually more than I expected, or this is actually less than I expected. I could take on more. I don't know. Just before we started recording, I started looking up articles about, there's a bunch of articles in this Twitter thread. And one that I stumbled across was basically saying how sometimes people do enjoy working, and sometimes that does happen to flow into the 45-hour, 50-hour, 60-hour range. Sure. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but sometimes it can have side effects where because like things are broadcasted so far out, like you have like GitHub notifications, you have emails, you have Slack telling you all like everyone's activity. So just because someone is like making commits at 11 p.m. doesn't mean that like you have to. Like maybe they just really that, you know, like for example, sometimes I can't let a problem go and I'm just like always thinking about it. And it just happens to be that I may or may not push a commit at, I don't know, 11 p.m. But that can have like bad side effects if, you know, these things are broadcasted everywhere and people see that and they're like, oh man, JP's doing that. Like I have to do that too. So I don't know. It's this weird, it's definitely like a weird balance thing. I definitely see where DHH is coming from, but I don't think that, I also definitely disagree with the other CEO who's posting things like, we're looking for people who can work 60 hours a week. We want like a coding rockstar ninja who can fuck shit up and kick ass and take names. It's like, I don't know about that, man.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And it's interesting what you're saying about, you know, individual motivation versus a company demanding you do something, because those are two very different things. And I think too, I like what you're saying about how, you know, just because you're making commits at 8 p.m. and that's showing up in the GitHub logs doesn't mean that others should feel, you know, the need to do so. You know, maybe that day you didn't start till noon. You don't know what those other people are doing. And it's actually one reason why I prefer in platforms to build to always use relative time. Like 3 hours ago, 2 hours ago, 6 hours ago, because A, it's a much easier to deal with time zones. So that's a hot tip. Always mock things up with relative time, because otherwise you have to parse a time zone and it's just more to go wrong. And then B, the other reason is because I like it being more relative, because to me, it's a more mindful state of not being so concerned with and always trying to calculate like when something happened. It doesn't matter as long as you kind of relatively know its age. And I think that that is a good approach for some of those things. But I am excited to start this new book, all this drama aside. So yes. I'm going to go ahead and read this summary of this book. So just a quick disclosure, I guess is a good way to say it, is this is a very, very short book. So this is a PDF reader. It's called Growing Applications in Practice, or more specifically, Growing Rails Applications in Practice. And I purposefully left off the Rails because I think regardless of the framework you're building in here, there's going to be a lot of great tips for scaling and growing something at scale. So hang on if you're not a Rails guy, and especially lean in if you are a Rails guy, because we have a lot of great tips here. But pretty much we are going to be talking about object-oriented design in the context of scale and growing an application and managing an application. But this is a super quick, only a 3 week sprint here. So it's this one PDF book. I will link it in the show notes so you guys can download it. I'm pretty sure it's like a name your own price. It's pretty affordable. And it's been an awesome read. Me and JP were both separately reading this and we're like, we have got to talk about this on the podcast. There's just so much good stuff here.
Yeah, totally. Was there like a little snippet, a little summary?
Yeah. So this is a really good summary of the book. It was in the first chapter that just kind of talks about kind of what we're going to be doing the next 3 weeks here. So here it is. Summary. In this book, we demonstrate techniques to scale large monolithic applications. Instead of introducing new patterns or service-oriented architecture, we will show how to use discipline, consistency, and code organization to make your code grow more gently.
What do you think about this whole monolith thing? No, don't answer that. That's like a whole can of worms of like.
Well, I'm kind of happy that last week we kind of riffed for like 15 minutes about monoliths versus service-oriented architecture and some of the pitfalls. And I feel like that's a hot topic right now on a lot of podcasts, so we don't really need to tear into that. But we are going to be talking about monoliths, I think, especially because both of us are more Rails guys. And I think that a lot of applications, PHP, others, .NET, Java, a lot of them are more of these monolithic approach and less of the service-oriented approach. Now, regardless of framework, of course, you can have a monolith or service. I get it. Okay. But I don't want to get caught in the weeds of, you know, the SO versus monolith. But yeah, so that's what this book is about. Really about scaling and how to think more elegantly about your code base to manage the mess.
Yeah, one thing that really stood out to me is one of the first things that they had mentioned is like, hey, we're going to let you in on a little secret, and it's this. It's very inconvenient, but large code bases are going to be large. And, you know, there's no way to just like make something that's big less overwhelming. It's going to be overwhelming, but, you know, you can make it less overwhelming with, you know,
yeah,
manageable.
I think what they're saying with that is regardless of architecture or choice, if you have something that's complex with a lot of models, it's gonna be complex with a lot of models. Regardless of whether you split them into services or how you approach it, it's going to be a lot to manage and you can't hold it all in your head. What I do like about that after that secret is it said, what we can do is try to make a code base that scales logarithmically is the language they use. And they were saying twice as many models should not mean twice as many problems, or three times as many models should not mean three times as many problems. So basically they're saying, if you can follow some of the tips and tricks that we lay out in the book, the idea is that adding more concepts or more features to your code base doesn't mean that it has to exponentially increase the complexity. And I feel like every day when I'm shipping code, that is how I feel, especially in my larger applications. I feel like the cost of adding one feature now is more expensive than adding five a year ago in some of the applications I work on. And so I'm really excited. I've already started implementing some of this stuff, but I'm really excited to talk about what I've learned already through this book and kind of dig into these rules. Are you ready?
Yeah, I loved how the pain scale, pain tolerance, or the level of complexity should be logarithmic. So like, you know, O log N and not O N squared.
Right, you know, that's the idea.
For those nerds out there.
Yeah, that's the idea, that new features should be very consistently logarithmically complex to add. It shouldn't make it harder and harder and harder to start growing the application. So the first section of this book was kind of this whole thing of new rules for Rails, but I think you can apply these general concepts to any framework you're working in or building in, but it is specifically for Rails.
Yeah, and it was like not really necessarily specific for Rails, but like for anything that's like MVC, because if you ever worked in like Phoenix, if you're an Elixir programmer or Laravel, it's, you know, these are basically all the same MVC type concepts, I think. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it definitely, even like I've worked on a little bit of iOS development, and even that's still MVC architecture, and a lot of this can stand and be some great tips to try to keep things consistent.
Yeah. So the first thing that they go through is talking about like your controllers. And so basically it's, you know, there's this question of like, what should go in your controllers and what should go in your models? And where do you really put things? Because, you know, you can like hack together an application and kind of just put everything anywhere. Isn't that crazy? Like you could put most of your shit in your views if you really wanted to.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of this is just like, how do you organize things? And, you know, to keep it very simple at a very high level, I think a good rule of thumb is for your controllers, make it just the HTTP requests. So just think of your controllers as handling just that. Like, should they, you know, send SMS text messages like with a service like Twilio, or should they send an email? Should they do all these other things? And the answer to that, in short, is basically no. Now, they take a very, very extreme approach towards like what their ideal controller looks like, but I thought it was very interesting because they were like, we have this skeleton. It's not even a skeleton. We have this like blueprint for what a controller should look like, and this is, we limit ourselves to just this. So like our controllers will only have these methods and they will only do these things. Everything else will be delegated outside, and that will like funnel it down to the models. And now, you know, doesn't necessarily all happen in the active record models, but then later in the book, they talk about like how you can abstract some of those things into regular models and how you can namespace those things to make it more organized. But before I get ahead of myself, do you want to like go through and talk about like this blueprint of a controller that they are just like, this is what we do?
Yeah, totally. I mean, the real meat of this section, this specific section to me, can be boiled down to one thing, which is controllers should only have CRUD actions: create, read, update, destroy. That's the only thing that your controller should do. And they talk through three or four times that they feel like are exceptions. And one of them is one that I've totally had to deal with, and it's a total bitch, is account merging. So merging two accounts together. And I have written this account merge controller that does that merge actions in line in the controller. I think we probably all have. And honestly, I think probably the first Rails application that I sold to a company and built for their infrastructure, which is still running today, by the way, built it over 5 years ago and it's still running today. Everything was in the controllers and very, very little was in the models. And so you can stick it anywhere. And so that's the exact opposite of what they're suggesting here. In this kind of template that they present, there is only those four actions. There's nothing else in the controller. And within each of those actions, there's only a single line method within each of those actions. Now, I like where they're going with this in theory, but to me, they take it a little bit too far in that it gets a little bit hard to read. What's your opinion there?
You know, I actually kind of like it. I fuck with this. Like, I think it's kind of cool. So to put it in perspective, I don't know, this is kind of hard to like talk about in an audio format. But for example,
well, let's just talk about one of the methods.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's just break down one of the controller methods.
So okay, so they actually do. You have multiple methods. It's not just the index, the show, the new, the create, or whatever. Like obviously, there's going to be like private methods that handle all these other things. So for example, let's take a look at the create method, which typically delegates to like creating a new object, or it's like very tightly coupled to the new method if you're in Rails land. But for the create method, there's two lines. It's literally build resource, like build underscore resource. And so this method is a private method. And what this does is basically it instantiates a new object in memory. And then it also like sets the parameters so that you can like save it as a record. So that's what build resource does. And then the next line in this method is save resource or render new. So like if it persists to the database, it's going to save it. If it doesn't, it renders the new page. And save resource is just another private method. And all this does is it attempts to save it. And if it does, it redirects to that resource. But it's just crazy because, you know, when you like Rails G scaffold post, you get like this massive controller that has all this stuff. It's like respond to format, HTML and JSON, and it has like this fat if else statement. But what they do is they actually break all of this down into like three line private methods on the class. And what's interesting too is they don't have any of these like callbacks, like any of these before actions that set the resource. All they do is have like a memoized like load resource thing. That way you can like just get the instance variable by calling the method, which I thought was pretty cool. That's pretty nifty.
I do like the idea of not using the before actions because it's easy to lose those that they're happening sometime because, you know, before action in, you know, new and create, but then you don't realize they're actually being run when you're looking at the individual methods. So I do like that approach. And I think that was really an elegant way to approach it. At the same time, yeah, I think it's really the concept, though, and the meat of the only exposed methods that are really to your application is those four. There's private methods, yes, but technically, your application can only interact with those four because they're all private methods.
Right, that's
what I meant by those four methods. And I think that is the main takeaway, and that you're keeping those all as simple and lightweight as possible, and that they are only writing something to the database. They're instantiating the model and creating the model of the database. They're not doing anything that mimics validations. They're not processing any emails. They're not charging any credit cards, like nothing else. They're dead simple. And no matter how that resource is being created, it's just being thrown right to the model. And that really sets us up for the next part here.
Yeah, it's crazy because like I'm just, you know, just in plain English, this is what this method is doing. For the resource, they have like for the example, it's a note. So it's like define create and it's build note, save note, or render new. And that's literally all this does. There's no business logic. There's no calculations. There's no mutations. There's no like crazy queries. It's literally just that. And if you go to the other methods, it's literally the same thing. Like if I want to update a resource, it's like almost speaking the algorithm. Load note, build note, save note, or render edit. And that's literally like verbatim the code, which
I think
is
really elegant. It would be so refreshing to open up a controller file and see that. It would be like, holy shit.
I know. Yeah. I'm on this new project I'm working on for my barber. I'm going to like try to do this. I already converted like the scaffold code for like a test resource that I made. And I like use these principles. And it's kind of cool. I don't know. My Rubocop screams at me though for some of this stuff. Like, I can't just do render new as a string for some reason. I have to use like a guard clause for that. But anyways, that's like neither here nor there. What's the next one on this bad boy?
Yeah, so we've talked through what they recommend for a controller. And really what we're doing is we're just creating that object. So then it's like, okay, well, where does all this logic go? You know, I had logic before that charged a credit card. I had logic that sent a push notification. So then it jumps right into models. And it starts with this concept of models should be really hard to misuse. And that to me was the next key takeaway from this whole section of the book is that you shouldn't be able to misuse your model in another in a context. And it gave an example I believe it was a send notification method. So before, in the controller would have a controller action that sent a notification to that user to be like, hey, welcome, and, you know, welcome them. And, you know, it abstracts this out and it recommends abstracting this out into a callback method. So it's when the new object is created to then send this method. And it's funny because I've heard so many times like, oh, callback methods can really screw you. And it even has like a big call out in the book. It's like, wait, aren't callback methods bad? Shouldn't we not be using these? But the argument they make is that you could otherwise create the resource and forget to have that send notification action, or you could forget to otherwise process a record in a way that it needs to be processed. And it gave some different examples of this. But if you do put it in a callback and you write that callback correctly, which we'll talk about more in a second, you can't make that resource wrong. And you can't misuse that model in a way that you'd have a record in an invalid state or in an unexpected state. So the little bit of an example I was giving, you would have the ability to create a user model without sending them a notification. And that's obviously not ideal. Like, you want that to be done every time. And so if you do this through a callback method, you can't do that. Every time the user is created, it will send that notification accordingly.
Yeah, so it's all about like data integrity. So to take what you said a little bit further, imagine that like the expected outcome is that every time a user signs up, you want to send a text message notification that says, hey, thanks for signing up, for whatever reason. Let's pretend that's our small little app. But like, if you just have it in the model without having callbacks, let's say you hop into Rails console like you shouldn't be doing on production, and you're like, for whatever reason, I'm gonna create a new user. So you do that through the console. If you don't have that in callback, what happens to that notification? It doesn't get sent because you just hit, you know, dot create bang, and nothing happened. Rails doesn't just magically automatically know that. However, if you use something like a callback, you can make sure that these things do get sent. You can check like, oh, did the object change? Then we can send this notification. So, you know, just things like that. Now, this is all about making sure that your data has integrity. And I think at some point later on in the book, we will talk about how to not have so many callbacks, because I definitely have stumbled upon active record models that are like filled with so many callbacks. Like, you have to scroll a couple seconds before you start seeing actual methods.
Yeah, I'm opening one of my projects right now because I have, let me see, this is probably eight callbacks on a model. I guess that's not too bad. I thought it was worse than that. And some of these have been extracted out, like a single callback will do more. And I think that's one of the tips that they're going to talk about in the future. But I love this idea that your controllers just create the resource and then your model just stores it, but then your model is responsible for all these things because you can't misuse your model. And I can't tell you how many times I've hopped into a console for a founder or someone I work with and created an object and then realize, oh, the controller actually does these four things before or after that object is created. So many different things, because so many objects have side effects and have to send a confirmation email or a receipt or whatever those things look like. And so this is a really good approach. The other thing that I love about it is it allows you to expose your model to other interfaces. So if you're building an API, this is a really good rule to follow, because you're so confident that your view controllers are only creating dumb models. They don't know anything about the model. And so then you can have that total separation between your API controller and your standard controllers, but you're confident that you're going to have integrity between the two controllers, and they're going to be creating objects and interacting with objects consistently between the two endpoints. Because I have more than once forgotten to write a single method within the API controller that the standard Rails controller had. And then all of a sudden I have invalid records, or, you know, users aren't getting that confirmation message, or whatever those little things look like, or the audit log object isn't being created. Those little things are so easy to do. And I love too, this whole section talks about how models should be handling all your validations, not your views. And definitely, I think all of us are guilty, especially with a complex validation, to just kind of shove it in the view, or worse still, shove it in the front end. Like, I'll just shove some JS. I'm confident I won't get a bad object committed to the database.
Yeah, it's like you have like an aha moment when you realize like your controllers should just be for HTTP requests. Very simple, you know. Just crud shit. And your model should just be like a one-to-one mapping with your database. It should just do like validations and Maybe you have some scopes in there, I think. Like, if you can just have your active record models have a bunch of scopes and have a bunch of validations, you'd be set. Like, imagine how nice that would be if you just opened up a nice active record model and that's all it was. And then you'd have, obviously, other files for other things that don't belong in your models.
One of the things it said that was super surprising is it said, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, in general, you should not have code anywhere that call methods on the model.
Interesting.
And that to me was like such like a brain explosion, because it's like, that's, I do that all the time. Like user add bank account, user process charge. Like there's so many different things I do on the user dot send notification and passed in a script string. But it's like, that's what it's recommending. You don't ever call a method on a model. You just CRUD, just create, read, update, destroy the model. Nothing else. And that to me was such an extreme stance, but it makes so much sense when you start thinking about it. Because again, if you're calling these model methods in other places, it's really easy to get a model in an unexpected state.
Right. So basically what they're saying is like, for let's talk about this notification example, for instance. Let's say you have a method on your user model that was send notification, and that sent out a Twilio notification, and it also sent out like an email, and it also sent out something to like
the in-app notification object,
yeah,
or whatever.
And it sent out like something for your tracking system so that Google Analytics knows that that was sent.
Totally.
Basically, they're saying is that it doesn't belong in the user model. It belongs in maybe like a notification model, for example.
Which makes a ton of sense if you think about it for a fucking second. But it's really hard to have this discipline. And that's why I like this book talks about discipline, consistency, and organization to make your code grow more gently. That's really all this is. It's not magic. It's one of those things about just work consistently at something and, you know, have the discipline to keep something simple, because that's what this comes down to. And I think we end up in these places to make it really easy to misuse our models. I mean, that send notification method is a perfect example. I think every one of my applications has some kind of user.sendText where I pass in a string, or user.sendNotification where I pass in a string, because it's there and I just grab it and it's convenient and it's easy. And, you know, at sometimes I don't have the text message object extracted into its own objects. Sometimes maybe that's why I started that way. And really it's a code smell, and I'm realizing it should be a code smell if you're using a model method somewhere else that isn't on a CRUD action.
Yeah, and if you think about it, like as we talk through this, you know, we're talking about CRUD actions on a notification object. Like, you know, when I send a notification, I'm, you know, creating a notification. You can like just CRUD everything. Just CRUD everything. That's at the end of the day, that's all you got to do.
Yeah. So then it was talking about models that are not backed by database is the next thing it talked through in the book, which was really interesting, and which is something that I've been doing more and more and more and more. Just it's so nice to have controllers and models not by the backed by the database. But it gave a couple examples of, like, you know, accepting credit card information using Stripe. You know, of course you don't want that stored in your database. If you are, stop it right now. Gave examples of sending notifications out, or a searches controller. A searches controller is a really good example of something that has a lot of controllers and a model to handle the searches, but you're not actually creating it in the database. You know, you can have searches slash new and create a search object, but you're not instantiating anything to the database in most cases. And so it talked about a lot of different tips. And it talked about specifically, which was really interesting, validating models that don't have a database backing. And that's not something that I generally have done. I can't think of a lot of, except form objects I have. So I guess that is using that. But it's a really interesting approach, and I feel like it could be really, really useful to use that same validation systems the framework has built in to validate something that may not necessarily be backed by the database.
Yeah, for example, like if you, I don't know, even just like for a simple search, like let's say for whatever reason that you're searching like phone numbers, like obviously you don't want to have letters in there or special characters. So you're going to have a regex that makes sure that search input is a phone number, right? Like that has to go somewhere. So that is obviously like a validation that would go in some non-active record model. But it's almost like, oh, dang, yeah, you can do that. Like you can have CRUD resources that aren't saved to the database. Like you don't need to save everything, which is kind of weird. I wonder why this is. Like, I wonder why people learn Rails in such a way that they almost design it poorly.
I think most people design most apps poorly.
Sure.
I mean, I know that's true for me until I've started to learn these disciplines and consistencies and dig more into it. I know that software doesn't think the way humans do. We tend to be very spaghetti brained and like, of course that has to do with that. And we don't have very compartmentalized boxes. And so to our brain, it makes perfect sense to send a notification from a user object. Like I'm talking about that user. I should send them a notification. But a computer's like, wait, what the fuck are you doing? This doesn't make any sense. And to some degree, I think that that's our downfailing is that we think about what we're doing like a person, and we think about it that way too much when we should be thinking of these as discrete pieces of data that are resources that are being created, like these little blocks, and they should be really simple and really stupid. But that's not the way our brain works, and that's not instinctual to us at all. At least that's what I would think.
You know what I think is interesting too is that I don't think there's an answer for this because like software is going to be complex. You have a big app, it's going to be big. I don't think there's an app out there that has tons of users, has tons of features, has tons of different mutations and states, different permutations, where you just hop on the code base and 5 minutes later you're like, yeah, I could ship a major feature. This is so easy. Like, I don't think that's ever going to happen. And I think it's interesting that there's a lot of books out there about like how you should design software and how you can organize software because there's so many different opinions. Like, you know, it sort of goes back to this whole services versus monolith thing. Now I understand that the argument is not necessarily a design thing, but more of like a stability thing. So like if one service goes out, your whole app doesn't die. But there's also the argument of like being able to abstract concepts out into different microservices versus like having everything inside of a monolith. Now, you know, some people will argue that having everything in a monolith is easier to reason about because it's just all there. Versus a service where, hey, everything's like abstracted into nice little pieces, so I'm able to digest little bits and pieces more. It's kind of like, okay, let's say we have a method that is 30 lines long and it's just an if else, right? And it's just a case statement. Now, you know, some people might argue that because everything is just all there, like I can reason about this really easily. Like I can literally just go through every single case and understand everything that's going to happen. Whereas like, let's say we broke down that method into like six different methods, you know, to some people that might be easier to digest because I could just see every single thing in those like little 2-3 line methods. And maybe that's easier to reason about. Now, other people that, you know, would prefer the 30 line method might say, well, that's too hard to follow because now I have to like go dig for all these answers when everything's like too abstracted. So I think the same goes for, you know, making these abstractions with your controllers. Like, you know, some people might even argue like, why can't I just have some of this logic in my controllers? Or why can't I just have some of this logic in my models? Like, I want to know everything that happens when I do a create. So like, if I create a user, I can just see everything in the controller that it's doing right there. It's sending an email, very obviously, it's sending a text message, and it's sending a notification to Google Analytics. And I could see that all right there, 3 lines, easy. Now, I don't know where I fall on this. I definitely think that there's like, you can take it a little too far, too extreme, but I don't know. There's definitely a level of like pragmatism that like needs to be applied. But
yeah,
I don't know. I wish there was like a silver bullet to making complex software not complex.
Well, I think you're right in that initial versions or MVPs, or when you're the only person on the code base, there's nothing wrong with having 4, 3, 5, 6 lines in a controller method. I think that that's okay. I really do. I think what we're talking about is trying to grow applications in practice.
Right.
That's our context here. You know, we've got 3 or 4 cooks in the kitchen or more, and we're trying to manage this monolith, and we're trying to do 25 actions on a newly created resource. That's the type of things that I'm dealing with in my day-to-day. I'm not dealing with 4 actions on a new object. I'm dealing with so many exponentially more than that, that you can't hold it all in your head, and it's too much to try to follow on one method. And when you try to add to those and try to modify this, that's the whole thing we're trying to get to, is the lower the pain tolerance to implementing changes and trying to get, once again, supple code.
Yeah, totally.
Awesome. Good stuff. Let's jump into picks.
Yeah. You go first.
All right, cool. So my first pick is actually a little bit of an odd one, but if you're an entrepreneur out there or you have a startup, so I have been doing all of my work, which is with better.com. I'm a development, single man development firm, but I have a couple contractors who help me out. But if you need any development work, you know, with better.com, and I can help you build Rails apps and whatever you're looking to do. But this whole time I've been doing this, which is 3 or 4 years now, I have been doing it as what's called a sole proprietor, which basically means that I just give the government my social security number and I just am a person who just works under my own name. But recently I've transitioned my company to an LLC. So I'm like a real company. I have a corporation in Delaware or whatever. And I was looking at ways to do this and it was all so shitty and tedious and expensive and just like had to talk to lawyers. And I was just like, there's got to be a better way. And actually Stripe has a way to create an LLC or a C corporation right from your Stripe account. I cannot tell you how painless and nice this process was. I'm not getting any money or anything for this. I wish I did. But, you know, it's been like 3 weeks since I formed my LLC and it cost me, I think it was like $400 or $500. They did all of the paperwork with the state. They just like, when they needed something, they sent me a text message and asked for it. They're like, hey, what's this? And I sent back a text. And they're like, okay, cool. I think we're good now. It's like, was so painless and easy. And when it was like, after like 3 days, they sent me the e-sign paperwork. I did a little e-sign click through. And then like 3 days later, I had my tax ID number and all my official paperwork from the government. And they even like connected me to, you know, accountants that can help me. And like, it was like Bench Accounting, a bunch of other integrations that make it super easy. And you don't have to be like me, like a development firm to do it. It could be for your startup. It could be for any company, actually. Like if you're trying to get your law office and a real corporation against it or an LLC, or, you know, you've been doing drop shipping, you're trying to make it more real. There's a lot of benefits to being an LLC depending on your state, and Stripe Atlas was beyond awesome, which I guess like everything that Stripe does is pretty kick-ass, so I guess that's to be expected.
Nice. That sounds very painless. My pick for this week is a Ruby gem called Dry Types, and what it is basically like Ruby objects on steroids, but it gives you like a type system. So like if you wanted to, like as we were talking about, you know, you might want to do model validations that aren't active record models. And so like you want a way to do that. And one thing you might want to do is you might want to validate like, oh, this input that I'm getting is a string. Now we all love Ruby because it's a dynamic language, but you know, maybe there are times when you're like, this would just be so much nicer if it was a little bit typed so that like I can ensure that I'm passing an integer, I'm passing in a Boolean, I'm passing in a string. You can include this thing called dry types and it will basically like give you that functionality. I think it has its like own DSL where you can like, you can make sure that the parameters that you're passing are whatever types you want them to be. And I thought that was pretty cool. It came out of a project called Virtus. I don't know how to pronounce it, but I don't know. I thought it was pretty kick-ass and I think I'm going to use it on an upcoming project. So I'm pretty stoked on that.
I like this trend of trying to get types into Ruby. I feel like it's a good way to go. And I do think that more strongly typed languages are more where the future is going because it's so much less error prone. I've just heard so many good things about using something that's more typed. And I feel like Rails, because it's so opinionated and Ruby, is so fitting for more like stronger types and starting to move in that direction. So I'm really excited about this trend. So that's cool. I'll have to check out that. I haven't actually like enforced any strong type system. I've done a little bit of like a roll your own kind of typing a little bit here and there for API endpoints, just to make it a lot easier to deal with incoming data. But this is cool. I'll have to check that out. Thanks for the pick. That's awesome.
Sweet.
Well, thanks for listening. If you would feel so inclined, we would love it if you could share this podcast with a friend, even if it's just word of mouth. Be like, hey, I was listening to this show and it's not terrible and it's about computer programming. Can you believe it? If that's how you feel, if you feel like it's terrible, then I don't know why you're still listening. And whatever, we still love you. Hope that you can listen to future episodes. And if you really like it, we would love for you to leave a review in iTunes. That'd be awesome. That actually bumps us in the search. It's so silly. No one uses iTunes, but that's what Apple uses for their podcast. And then everybody looks at Apple for what's popular. So it really helps us to leave reviews in the Apple iTunes store. I haven't said that whole spiel in a while, so I just did it. Anyway, thanks for listening, and we'll see you guys next week.
All right. See you guys.